Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And good old Russell, he was really...
Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships. We talk about
it. What does he want? And, you know, that is the hardest part of sexual addiction. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Cheats, a.k.a. Carol the Coach, and I got to tell you, oftentimes a man or a woman will want to recover from sexual addiction, and yet at the same time, they're just not sure what they need to do to make it better. And that uncertainty makes them fear that they won't be able to get the job done. And so tonight we're going to be talking with Timothy Stein from Willow Tree Counseling, and he's going to be talking about the relapse autopsy and what is that. And certainly many of you may not know, but my husband works in the funeral home business, so the fact that we're talking about autopsies, I get that. And really, when you cut away and dissect what caused the death, you then find out what the problems were. And the good news about sexual addiction is you don't have to die to be able to dissect what are the problems and what are the issues, the patterns, the choices that have contributed to frequent relapses and slips so that you can learn from it. And Timothy says, after all, the only mistake that is worthless is the one you do not learn from. So if you're willing to learn from what you know, what has happened in your life, what contributed to the problem, what do you need to do differently? If you're willing to learn from that, you too can get healthy from sexual addiction. Now, that doesn't mean that you won't have the problem anymore, but it will mean that you will acquire the skills you need to take care of the problem. And that is so important. You've heard me say it before. You need a strong recovery plan. And, you know, it's interesting because I so oftentimes quiz my clients and say, okay, now there are 10 components to a recovery program. What are the components and which ones do you use? I believe the more likely you are to work on all 10 of the components, the more likely you'll find success quickly. And even the successful people, they have to really think about that. And oftentimes, they're only able to get 6 or 7 of those components. So it'll be interesting to see whether Timothy Stein, if he and I are on the same page in terms of components, you know, what are the things you have to do to maintain recovery? And for people that slip or relapse, what are they not doing? As opposed to looking at, hey, what are you doing? What are you not doing that would maintain that sobriety? Now, clearly, there's always things that a person is doing. I mean, obviously, that's what addiction is all about. But when you work it, it works. And that's why I always tell my clients, you know, if you're willing to do the hard work over and over and over again, what you'll find is it becomes natural, it becomes necessary, and it becomes normal. And then it doesn't feel like you're altering your existence. It feels unnatural when you don't do it. I mean, have you ever exercised and you absolutely hated it? You didn't want to do it. You don't know why you're doing it. And then, you know what? One day you realize that you've missed your workout, and it's like there's a craving to figure out and find ways to get it back in your life. Well, that's the same thing with recovery tools. So Timothy is going to be talking about, you know, what's the nature of the relapse? And what choices did you make or behaviors did you do immediately before your relapse? What behaviors or choices did you make before that and before that and before that? So he's really going to be talking about what were your behaviors prior to the relapse? And then, of course, after reviewing your behaviors and your choices, are there similarities to past slips and relapses? And then, obviously, he'll want you to look at your three circles. You know, what are your deal-breaking behaviors? What are the slippery slope behaviors? And what are your healthy behaviors? And that, in and of itself, can be very, very healthy in terms of identifying and dissecting what it is you need for recovery. So I'm so looking forward to interviewing him. He's a master at what he does, and I cannot wait to hear about this new autopsy relapse plan and, of course, how he feels about the recommendations that he's going to be making to improve your sense of recovery. Now, you know this is a show where I talk about all sorts of different things. I know that I wanted to interview a woman about sexual abuse, and she said, oh, Carol, my book is out, and I'm really good at what I do, but I don't know if it's pertinent to sexual addiction. And what I know to be true is that many of my addicts and many of their partners have been sexually abused. And I said, oh, yeah. You know, we need to talk about this topic because it contributes to the sexual reenactment trauma, as well as partners oftentimes will magnetize people in their lives that either sexually abuse their kids or they have sexual abuse in their past. So I'm a big, big believer in understanding what trauma is all about. Now, I was reading an article on neuroscience and the secrets of your second brain. And interestingly enough, this woman that wrote this was saying that when it comes to your moods, decisions, and behavior, the brain in your head is not the only one doing thinking. Okay, if you've been listening to me, you know that I say we make decisions using our head, how we think, our hearts, what we feel, and our gut, what we intuitively know. And she says, if you're late for work, missed a crucial meeting, and now your boss is mad at you, you may walk straight past that salad bar and head for something to medicate the feelings. You can't help yourself. At times of stress, the brain encourages you to seek out comfort foods. This much is well known. What you probably don't know is that the real culprit may not be the brain in your skull, but your other brain. You know, your body contains a separate nervous system that is so complex, it has been dubbed the second brain. It has over 500 million neurons, about five times as many as the brain of a rat, and it's about 9 meters long. It stretches from your esophagus to your anus. And this could be the brain responsible for your craving under stress, for crisps, chocolate, cookies, and of course, sex. Embedded in the wall of the gut, the ENS, the enteric nervous system, has long been known to control digestion. However, what we know about the gut is in conjunction with the brain, it also can help you sense environmental threats and then influence your response. So, of course, we as sexual addictions therapists wonder, how does this play a role, if any, in how people medicate themselves when they're under stress with sex? You know, and what she has found is that there are the second brain, the gut, is made up of various types of neurons, and it has its own version of a blood-brain barrier to keep its psychological environment stable. It produces hormones, about 40 neurotransmitters, and it produces dopamine, the same dopamine that you find in your head. Interestingly enough, and intriguingly, about 95% of the serotonin present in the body at any time is in the gut, the ENS. So this researcher says, what are neurotransmitters doing in the gut? Well, in the brain, dopamine is a signaling. It's a signaling of molecular structure in the internal reward system. Okay, now, that's why so oftentimes certified sexual addictions therapists are looking at the brain, because I know that it can feel like if you have a compulsive behavior, you must be weak, you must have a moral issue, and you don't realize that a lot of this stuff is entrenched in the brain. And if we work with the brain and we distribute new neurocircuit pathways in the brain, you're much more likely to be successful. And so it's important to establish healthy behaviors that are going to not only interfere with the neurocircuitry that occurs in the brain, but also to develop new pathways that transmit signals both in the brain and the ENS, which will then provide serotonin and dopamine. Now, serotonin is what we call the feel-good molecule, and it's involved in preventing depression and regulating sleep, appetite, and body temperature. It's produced in the gut, it gets into the blood, and it's involved in repairing damaged cells in the liver and lungs. Did you know that about serotonin? Are you on a serotonin reuptake inhibitor? That's like Prozac or Lexapro, Prestique, Effexor, Paxil, an antidepressant. That's another way to circumvent the way the brain is affected. And there are so many positive ways to create new pathways. And serotonin and dopamine are both mood regulators. They're both chemicals that make you feel better. And neurotransmitters produced in the gut, although they cannot get into the brain, theoretically, they could enter small regions that lack a blood-brain barrier, including the hypothalamus. Okay, I know I'm using a lot of big terms, but this is some research that substantiates why we want addicts to create new experiences that make them feel good. And that's why the three circles are so important. That outer circle, which are the healthy sexual and developmental behaviors. You know, exercise may not make you feel good, but guess what? It makes me feel good. Playing golf doesn't make me feel good, but guess what? It might make you feel good. And so you've got to have some of those behaviors that are healthy, that help to equalize, if you will, life stressors. And so this article talks about the secrets of your second brain and actually talks a lot about ENS, which is a part of the central nervous system that evolves in the gut. And so I hope you'll look it up. It's by Emma Young, and she's doing a lot of research on what she calls gut instincts. Very interesting. Now, if you are somebody who feels like you too want to change your behaviors and change the way your life is going, you're going to have to look at your lifestyle and the things that you need to do to make a difference in both your functioning and your relationships with others. And that's why we have Timothy Stein on. And again, he's a master at figuring out what people need to do to deal with relapse and slips. So Timothy, welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach. How are you this evening?
Oh, I am wonderful, Carol. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I feel like this topic is the topic that addicts and their partners want to hear about, because slips and relapses are part of the addiction process. And so I was so amazed at your relapse autopsy and the questions, and it's almost like a mini workbook that people can use to really take a look at their behaviors. What made you decide to go ahead and put this together?
I put this relapse autopsy together because I found myself having almost the same identical conversation with client after client after client who was having a relapse at the time. And the conversation sort of revolved around, well, what had happened with the relapse, what was going on leading into the relapse, and then all the different things that tend to play into relapses. And I had this conversation, and it got down to where it was almost a script that I could walk through with my clients, and we'd get done with the script, and they're like, oh, I get it. I see how I got here. I have an idea of some things to change, and I have an idea of what to do differently. And because it had evolved to the point where it was almost like a script, I thought to myself, you know, I love working with my clients. I love seeing them, but there's probably better things that we could use this time for. And if I can help them walk through this process on their own, and they could come into my office with that answer, and then we could start the conversation from there on how do you implement it, what's going to get in the way, you know, have you come to this answer in the past, and you haven't been able to sort of keep it in place, and let's talk about how you do that. I thought I would love to be able to start at the end of this conversation and continue on the work from there. So I took some time, and I started writing down what were some of the typical topics, typical questions that I found myself exploring and talking to clients about, and it evolved into, I love the way that you do describe this, Carol, as sort of this mini workbook to sort of help them autopsy their most recent relapse to understand what was going on so that we could start doing this work. Or, you know, if they're not my client, at least they could figure out some answers and start putting some pieces together for themselves. Because whether they're my client or not, I really wish, you know, sobriety and continued sobriety for everyone out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, some of the questions really have the addict looking at, you know, what is it that triggers me? And so let's go through this a little bit. Share with
sure.
me what you felt were the most fundamental questions that you kept scripting with your clients.
The fundamental question that really started me on this journey was something that I call the 2-week window. And I unfortunately have no research to back this up other than what I have seen consistently with clients that I have worked with in recovery. And the 2-week window that we started talking about was when there is a significant event happening. The ones that seemed to come up most often was a client whose parents or family were going to come visit, or they were going to go visit their parents or family. And we would start talking about this 2-week window because they seemed to relapse leading into the visit. Sometimes they'd relapse during the visit. And then the one that seemed to be most surprising was they would come back from the visit or their family would leave. They'd feel good. They'd feel grounded for about a week. And then in that second week, they would relapse. And so we started talking about this 2-week window, and we talked about it as the 2-week window of vulnerability. There's a significant event happening, and 2 weeks prior to that event, you got to recognize you're vulnerable because you're anticipating this event, you're anticipating the anxiety, you know, you're hoping it goes well, but you're not sure. When we visit our family, oftentimes it sort of brings up old feelings, and sometimes we feel like we're that little kid going back into mom and dad's house all over again. So recognizing that there's this window of vulnerability 2 weeks prior to the visit, you got to recognize your vulnerability while you're there. But the one that most people were missing and was afterwards, that there's this 2-week window after this visit where you got to recognize that you're vulnerable. And that means I need to be extra careful with making sure my routine is in place. I need to be extra careful with my boundaries. I need to make sure that I've really got my middle circle contained. I liked what you were saying earlier about outer circle behavior. In those 2 weeks after, I needed to make maybe a little bit extra effort to do that outer circle behavior, whether that's exercise or whether that's golf or whether that's painting or whether that's, you know, spending time in the garden. But this whole idea of this 2-week window of, hey, there's a significant event, you need to have it on your radar, and you need to recognize you're vulnerable 2 weeks before, during, and 2 weeks after, and not just sort of get through the event and go, oh, whew, good, and then relapse a week later. And that
Absolutely.
Conversation
and
seemed to be where we started.
Yeah, now, you've been working in this field for how long, Tim?
I have been working in this field for about a little over five years now.
Okay, and so person after person, month after month, year after year, you notice this 2-week pattern. And
yes.
truly, it does help when you can almost predict to the client, you're going to be really vulnerable here.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, as a result, you predicted that, and what you expected most from them is for them to have a good recovery plan put together in case they found that vulnerability and really include those healthy behaviors in addition to the recovery tools.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And when I was having that conversation, you know, I found people were oftentimes surprised. They would have a relapse and they would come in. I would say, okay, well, what was going on that was significant in your life the day of the relapse? And oftentimes they would say, well, nothing, really. And then we would walk through it. Okay, well, what was happening the day before? What was happening the week before? What was happening in the last 2 weeks? And when they started expanding that conversation beyond what was happening that day, they would realize, oh, I just had a challenging meeting with my boss the week before, and I was really kind of anxious about that. Or my wife and I were going into couples therapy, you know, and I was really anxious because I had, you know, it was a disclosure session or something. You know, suddenly these events that were coming up within that 2-week window would start to show up on their radar, and they were like, oh, and I guess that did happen, and I had totally forgot that that was there and how anxious I was or how angry I was about that or how scared I felt about that or whatever that intense emotion was. And so as we started to, well, what was happening the day after, what was coming up the next week, suddenly, you know, this picture would start to expand, and when they would start to see this 2-week window, and it suddenly became more clear to them of the things that they had to be aware of going into and out of events instead of just going through them assuming everything was going to be fine.
Well, and you highlighted something. I mean, clearly people who are addicts, there are many reasons that may trigger a slip or a relapse, and yet we say that's no excuse because you've got to do the next right thing, and in knowing what's going on, you've almost got to head it off at the pass to bypass it. And so when you talk to your clients, they were able to go, oh, yeah, it was that meeting. It was talking to the boss. It was a fight with my wife or whatever. And for those people, because they weren't looking into the future, they didn't necessarily have some of the tools you need ahead of time, but they were able to gather what they needed for the future, correct?
Exactly. Yes. It's kind of like there's that old story about three blind men trying to describe an elephant, and they're each feeling a different part of the elephant, and they can't quite get what this thing is they're feeling. And when you take a step back and can see the whole picture, you get a much different understanding and perspective of what's happening. The advantage I have as a therapist is I'm not wrapped up in the middle of my client's event. And so I have a neutral perspective, and I'm not emotionally attached to it. And so I get to step back a ways. And part of what this conversation was helping my clients learn to take a step back from their life to start looking at it from a different perspective. You know, you're absolutely right. All kinds of things trigger clients. When I was putting this together, one of the things I did was I went and I asked some other therapists for feedback. You know, this is kind of what I'm seeing. This is what I'm putting together. Do you have ideas? And I really appreciated the feedback. Some of the therapists said, you know, there are some physical sensations that my clients find really triggering. What did you see? What did you hear? One that surprised me that wasn't on my radar at the time was, what did you smell? For some clients, just certain smells or certain perfumes will sort of set them off. And starting to be aware of what are the different triggers that sort of bring up your addiction that you can now start to be aware of. So when you are walking by maybe a wall of jasmine,
mm-hmm.
you can start to say, oh, you know what? I love jasmine, but this smell also brings some stuff up. So I kind of need to be really careful right now. I need to really keep my boundaries up. I need to make sure that I'm sort of got my filters on with the people that are around me. But it's important that they've been able to take that step back from their life, recognize the trigger, whatever that might be, identify it, and then take whatever action they need to around how do I put boundaries around myself as I'm in this place where I'm vulnerable to possibly relapse.
Oh, and so a lot of the autopsy, the relapse autopsy, is about what experiences did you have prior to the relapse, and then what choices mm-hmm. did you make or behaviors did you do immediately
yeah.
before the relapse? So somebody who smells that smell, and maybe it on some unconscious or subconscious level takes them back to a previous girlfriend, a previous experience, a previous location. Once they identify that that is the trigger, what do you ask them to do next?
Well, you know, the simplest answer to that, I think, is the 3-second rule. And then I'm constantly preaching to my clients, you will hear people in meetings talk about the 3-second rule in one particular way, and you need to know they're not my clients. And those are the people that talk about the 3-second rule as, well, I've got 3 seconds to look or to think about something before I have to look away. And the ones who are really wrapped up in their addiction have the, and then after I look away, if I look back, I have another 3 seconds. And I keep telling my, they are not my clients, because that is not the spirit of the 3-second rule. That actually does more damage than it does good. The spirit of the 3-second rule. So if you're in a situation and you get that trigger.
Yeah, now let's pretend that our listeners know nothing about the 3-second rule to begin with. So start off and explain it. Yeah.
So the 3-second rule is when something triggers you, or the way you'll hear it described, when something triggers you, you've got 3 seconds before you have to look away. The actual intention of the 3-second rule is to acknowledge the thoughts that come into our head are reflexive. I don't have a conscious choice to prevent thoughts from popping into my head. The triggers that we experience are reflexive. I don't have a conscious choice to not be triggered by the jasmine if I'm walking by it. So the spirit of the 3-second rule is the addictive thoughts, the addictive triggers are going to pop into your head. You're not responsible for that. Don't beat yourself up because you were triggered. Don't beat yourself up because you had an addictive thought, because beating yourself up ends up reinforcing the addiction from a deeper level. So the idea is don't beat yourself up because that came up, but once you are aware that that thought's in your head, once you're aware that that trigger has happened, now you're responsible for what you do with it. And rather than beating yourself up for being addicted, now you can say, okay, so now I'm aware that I've got this thought. I can say the serenity prayer. I can go walk somewhere else. I can avert my eyes. I can make a phone call to other people in my program. I can make a phone call to my therapist and leave a message about what's going on. I can take some deep breaths and just get through it. I can take action of some sort to take responsibility for the thought or the trigger and not go with it. And so that's the spirit of the 3-second rule, is, and typically that process of recognizing the thoughts in my head and taking the action to take responsibility for what I do should take about 3 seconds.
And, you know, to somebody who has not heard of that rule, 3 seconds may seem like something that's just so quick, but truly that is long enough to then alter your behavior and make choices that are much, much healthier for you. So I appreciate that is a choice you can make at the time of any kind of trigger.
Absolutely. And it's one of those tools that starts building on itself. You know, most of the things we're trying to teach people in recovery, most of the things we're trying to teach them are skills that the more that they practice them, the better they get at them. And the 3-second rule is the same way. At first, when you're first trying to catch those addictive thoughts or kind of recognize those triggers and then start to take responsibility for it, it's going to feel impossible and difficult and challenging. And if you just give up, you're going to wallow in your addiction for a long time. But if you recognize, you know, this feels really challenging, but I bet the more that I practice this, the more that I use it, the more that I consciously recognize my thoughts, recognize my triggers, and then start using tools, the more automatic it becomes and the easier it becomes, to the point where I had one client who came into my office and said, you know, I had the weirdest experience today. I was walking down the street, and I'm walking down the street. Suddenly I found myself saying the Serenity Prayer, and I couldn't figure out why I was saying the Serenity Prayer. And I stopped and I turned around and I realized that there was a woman dressed rather seductively that I had just passed. And I hadn't even been aware that I'd been triggered by her, but I'd automatically kicked into the Serenity Prayer. And what I noticed wasn't the trigger. What I noticed was the Serenity Prayer. And I love that story.
Because somebody is running on automatic. Their brain is telling them what they need to do.
Exactly, exactly. And that comes from practice. It comes from, you know, it becoming rote memory.
And so that's part of that relapse autopsy, is it's practicing something to the degree that all of a sudden it becomes natural, normal, and necessary, and it helps in that recovery process, almost unconsciously, but at least subconsciously, like you said, they think about,
yeah.
Now, why did they do that? And then they realize that they were utilizing healthy recovery skills.
Well, the relapse autopsy isn't necessarily about that. What the relapse autopsy is more about is helping them to recognize what are the likely thoughts, what are the likely triggers, what are the things that come up that they can start being aware of so they can start practicing to use those tools. So it's sort of a, how do you start to recognize the red flags so that you know when to sort of kick in your recovery into overdrive?
Yeah, and that makes sense, that it's really recognizing what is triggering you and what to do about it.
Oh, yeah.
So you review your behaviors and choices over and over and over again, and you look at, now, what has contributed to my feelings, my slips, or my relapses? And so you say that then you associate that to the changes that are in the inner, the middle, and the outer circle. So explain that.
Yeah. So as you start to pay attention to what are the triggers that are coming up, part of this relapse autopsy also asks you, well, what were you doing for self-care when you were right before you relapsed? What were you using as your motivation for holding on to your sobriety? And so the last part of this relapse autopsy is really, in a sense, exploring what's the outer circle stuff that you're doing. What are the tools that you currently have in place that help you to stay sober that you're aware of? And so part of this relapse autopsy is about what are these triggers that come up so that you can be aware of them to use the tools. And then the other piece of it is, and what is the ongoing work that you're doing to help yourself stay grounded? And, you know, there's a story, here's my little tangent. There's a story I particularly like. Years ago, I had a client who was into a keto, which I know very little about, but he explained that it has to do with, it's a martial art that has to do with keeping your center and using your opponent's energy against them. And in the keto community, there's this story. And the story goes that there was a young student who asked his master, how is it that you always keep your center? You never lose your center. And the master looked at him and said, oh, no, you misunderstand. I lose my center all the time. I'm just faster at recognizing it and getting back to my center than you are. And I love that story because for me that represents exactly what this relapse autopsy is all about. It's not a tool that's going to help you get into your center and stay in your center, because quite honestly, I don't believe that that's realistic.
Okay.
It's a tool that's going to help you get into your center and start paying attention to what are the things that pull me out of my center, so that when I recognize I'm out of my center, I can use the tools I've got to get back there. And what are the ongoing things I can do in my life that help me to stay more in my center so it's harder for me to slide out? And the combination of those things, of what do I do to stay centered, and what are the signals that let me know that I'm sliding out of center, and is so important, so important.
Okay, so again, so much of what you are doing is prevention. Once you've identified what the issues are, what can you do to build in the awareness and healthy choices to prevent a relapse from occurring? And so that's prevention.
Mm-hmm. And like you were saying earlier, that as CSATs, we pay so much attention to the brain. One of the things that we know is that the behaviors we do impact our brain. They sculpt our brain to reinforce the behaviors we've just done. And so if you've been an addict for a long time, you've sculpted your brain to reinforce your addiction. Part of what I'm hoping people do with a relapse autopsy and what they get out of it is it helps them to start creating different behaviors. And every time they recognize a trigger, they recognize an addictive thought, they think to themselves, oh, I need to do, excuse me, I need to do my self-care. They're they're sculpting their brain. Excuse me just a second.
I tell you what, you go get a glass of water, and I'll continue to talk a little because it sounds like you're all choked up here.
I got it.
Okay, cool.
So every time that they do that, that they are actually sculpting their brain to support them into their recovery. They're sculpting their brain to start reinforcing sobriety. And so that's really the point, is we're using a behavioral tool to help them understand their behavior and change their behavior to sculpt their brain neurologically to support them to start holding on to sobriety, which will reinforce the sobriety and help them make the major changes in their life that they want to make.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So then you also talk about defense mechanisms, the many defense mechanisms that we all use in daily life, but truly an addict will use denial or justification, rationalization, minimization. So tell us a little bit about the actual defense mechanism of justification and denial.
I have yet to meet an addict who doesn't have a very elaborate denial and justification system. And one of the very first things that we do is start to challenge that. And we start to challenge it by educating them. You need to start to understand, how do you create denial? How do you justify your addictive behaviors? And in your brain, in the moment, make them okay. Because if the problem with addictions are not that the addict recognizes this behavior doesn't work for me, I don't want to do this behavior anymore because it creates more problems for me than it solves, and so I'm not going to do this behavior anymore. It's like the old 12-step saying, getting sober is easy, staying sober is hard. Problem with addictions isn't that people don't have that realization. The problem with addictions is that down the road, that very same behavior is going to seem like the best idea in the world. And when that happens, their addict brain, because of a trauma response, which we actually talked about in our last show, if I remember right, their addict brain is going to kick in and start justifying, oh, yeah, no, that is a really good idea, and here's why it's okay. And the justification is going to make no sense. But in the moment, it sounds fabulous. Oh, yeah, no, that's okay because I'm really angry at my wife, and she deserves for me to sort of act out. And as long as she doesn't know, it's not going to really matter. Or any other justification. It's not really my addiction because, you know, I didn't really finish the act. I only went halfway through it. That's okay. And when we look at those statements in the cold light of reality, they typically make no sense whatsoever. And even when clients are telling me, well, this is why I thought it made sense, you know, you can just see them sort of smirk and feel embarrassed and sort of shifting in their chair going, as they're saying it, going, God, I can't believe I believed that in the moment. Part of the problem is that's the denial justification mechanism. So there's an important piece about recovery and an important piece that I want them to get out of a relapse autopsy of learning what is the typical pattern I use to deny my behaviors as being a problem. What is the typical pattern I use in my addiction to justify my addictive behaviors as being okay? And if they can start to understand and pay attention to, oh, typically when I want to go into denial, I start to create everything as black and white. Typically when I want to go into my addiction, I justify it as my wife doesn't understand me. And so if they can start to pay attention to those, and they go through their relapse and like, oh, yeah, I justified this one because I was angry at my wife, and I started making very black and white statements about what was acting out and what wasn't. So now I need to start paying attention to, when I have thoughts about being angry and annoyed with my wife, and I need to start paying attention to when I've got black and white thoughts going on, and I have to start recognizing those as triggers. And if I can start to pay attention to my thought process, again, this is learning to take that step back from their life and look at it. Oh, right now I'm angry at my wife. I know that that's a part of what goes on in my addiction. It's one of the things that often makes me vulnerable to relapse. Maybe this would be a good time to make a phone call and talk to somebody about what's going on with my wife instead of just holding on to the resentment and walking through this pattern that ends in me relapsing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was sitting there thinking, I was just talking with a client who has been doing really, really well. And just in the last couple of weeks, he has flirted with some behaviors that are clearly addict's behaviors. One is he had a Victoria's Secret catalog, and he just thumbed through it. And when he thumbed through it, he said, all I did was thumb through it like this. And he goes, I mean, I really didn't look at the pictures. And then the next week, he was watching a video, and a woman's breast caught his eyes, and he replayed that video. He had not DVR'd it, but, yeah, DVR'd it, and looked at it three times, and he said to the group, you know, that wasn't addict behavior. That was just a guy being a guy. And clearly, between the rationalization he was using and the justification that he was using, he was able to justify his behavior as being normal, as opposed to, these are behaviors that are activating my reward center, and as a result, you know, maybe next week, next month, or in 3 months, I could head towards a full-fledged relapse. And so the group,
yeah.
And of course that's the beauty of group, the group was really good at saying to him, hey, Tom, we're concerned that you're participating in behaviors that you aren't even paying attention to. It's almost like the addict is on automatic here, and the new and improved Tom is not paying attention. And so that's what you're saying, that it really, so much of this autopsy is becoming aware and paying attention both to present-day behaviors or behaviors that have already been a slippery slope, gotten somebody in some trouble, and it keeps them from pursuing them again.
Absolutely. Sometimes when I talk about the relapse autopsy, I will tell people that the point of the relapse autopsy is not that you're never going to relapse. I mean, that's where we hope that they're going to get, and hopefully they'll get there sooner rather than later. But what I really hope they get from the relapse autopsy is by walking through it, they have a picture of, oh, here is the path that I walked. Here were the choices that I made. Here were the red flags that I ignored that allowed me to walk into my relapse. And what I really want them to do is, oh, this is the path, and so I need to put a barrier up on this path so that if they relapse again, they relapse a different way. I don't want them to go through a relapse, not learn from it, and then start using that path repeatedly. If they have a relapse, I want them to learn from it so that if they relapse again, it's because they went through another way, and then they can learn from that one and say, oh, and I didn't realize this piece was important, put a barrier up there, and if they relapse, it's a completely different way. I want them blocking the pathways that they typically use into relapse.
Well, 100%, and you're so clear about the fact that anytime you make a bad choice, if you learn from it, it's not a failure, it's something to grow from. And and that is what recovery is all about.
Yeah, progress, not perfection.
Mm-hmm. Well, and clearly, even at the beginning of your autopsy relapse worksheets, I mean, you say a mistake is not a failure unless you don't learn from it. And so you're all about what I call mindful compassion. You don't want people to spin into how much they hate themselves for having relapsed. You want them to learn from it and to grow from it to prevent them from having further slips and relapses.
Oh, absolutely. You know, everybody is walking their own path, and everybody's going to make mistakes. if we beat ourselves up every time we make a mistake, that's going to create so many problems. And it does create so many problems with addiction, especially when people are holding on, I need to be perfect. And when you open it up and say, you know what, I don't need to be perfect, but I can learn from a relapse. And what I find is that when people have been using this for a while and they start to get more sobriety, they start applying this pattern not to just, I had a relapse, but they start applying it to, you know what, I found myself in middle circle. I found myself with my toe on the edge of acting out, and I realized that here's the things that I was doing that I needed to pay attention to. And so they start using the same process, not as a relapse autopsy, but as an almost relapse autopsy. And then as they keep going, they use it as a almost going into middle circle kind of autopsy. And they continually use it, but how they learn is from making mistakes and then paying attention to what had happened with that mistake so that I can do it differently next time.
Okay, so now, obviously, you have your clients look at events and situations and interactions, and you really have them dissect and examine what happened immediately before they made a poor choice. And your hope is that if they really look at the events, situations, or interactions before their relapse, the day of their relapse, the day before their relapse, they'll gain some helpful information for the next time. And
go ahead, Carol, please.
Well, I was going to say, and I find that that can sometimes be agonizing for a client because there's a part of them, there's like one part of their brain that knows what contributed to the problem, but there's another part of the brain that just wants to forget it and move on. So you have really worked diligently to help them reframe that so that there isn't that attachment to self-loathing and disgust and self-hatred. You know, so many of our addicts, you know, it's that auto-exacerbating cycle of something triggers them, they act out, they hate themselves, which becomes a trigger for need to medicate, which then, of course, feeds that whole addiction cycle. And so I'm curious as to what kind of recommendation you give them in terms of the events, situations, or interactions that have happened prior to. What do you tell them to do?
Well, I tell them you need to look at them. You need to understand them. This is exploring that whole two-week window, and when we're going through that process, so much of the focus is on learning from what happened. I talk about it as you need to start being able to pay attention to what's coming down the pike in your life, what's on, and have that stuff on your radar. And the only way you're going to be able to start putting that stuff on your radar is if you look at what happened this last time. Not to beat yourself up with it, but to understand what things on your radar do you have to start looking for so that when you see them, you can start saying, oh, I'm going on a business trip. I know that I'm vulnerable when I go on business trips, so I need to start putting a plan in place so when I'm on that business trip, here's my plan to stay sober through the business trip because I know I'm a little bit more vulnerable there. And what that plan looks like varies from client to client, but I'm less interested in what their specific plan is. I'm more interested in, did they pay attention to there was something they had to be ready for? Did they start thinking about it? And then hopefully if they got through it sober, let's talk about what worked. If they didn't get through it sober, what didn't work that you need to remember for next time? So next time the business trip comes up, hopefully you can, you know, get through it successfully with sobriety. And like so many things in recovery, this is a lot about moderation. And so part of the moderation is don't beat yourself up for having had a relapse or having made a mistake. But the other side of that moderation is, but let's also at the same time honestly look at what were the consequences for the relapse. You know, is your wife angry? Is your wife hurt? Have you lost the trust with her that you had built up? Are you on shaky ground with your boss? Does your computer have a virus and it's frozen up and it's not working again? Did your wife kick you out of the bedroom? Has your daughter lost respect for you because she found out what was going on? What are the consequences? Not to beat yourself up, but to sort of stay in that place of moderation of, I need to not beat myself up, but I also need to be very honest about what are the consequences that happened to me, so I can use those to create motivation so that the next time I'm struggling or the next time these triggers come up and I'm like, oh, you know, I just want to ignore them and blow by them, that you've got that motivation to say, no, hold on. Last time I did that, this is what happened. I don't want that to happen again. That's why I'm going to remind myself it's time to pick up the phone and make a phone call. It's time to say the serenity prayer to myself. It's time to, you know, pick up the big book and read a chapter. It's time to open up my daily meditation book and see what, you know, my higher power has waiting for me. So it's that balance of, you know, self-acceptance and at the same time the reality of what the consequences of your choices were.
Well, yeah, that totally makes sense. Now, as people listen to you, let me remind our listeners that they're listening to Timothy Stein, and he is a part of a counseling group, and it's Willow Tree Counseling. How can people get a hold of you, Tim, if they want to find out more about this or they want to participate in some workshops or programs that you're offering?
The easiest way to find information about us is on our website, which is willowtreesantarosa.com, all one word. And there's all kinds of information on there about the groups that we run, the workshops that we offer, the work that we do individually and in couples. They can also email me. My email address is tim@willowtreesantarosa.com, or they can give me a call. My phone number is area code 707-888-9098.
Okay, and so if they go to your website, what kind of information will they gain from accessing your website?
Well, one thing that they'll gain is they can get a copy of the relapse autopsy. If they go to the website, under the more information tab, under the client access tab, there's a forms option. And if they click on that forms option, they can go into the website and they can download a PDF version of the relapse autopsy. So if there are clients out there that are struggling, or if there's therapists out there that would find this helpful with their patients, clients, they can access the relapse autopsy and they can start using it themselves just by downloading it off my website.
Yeah, and what a wonderful tool that would be for anybody who's really wanting to examine their behavior. And I can't imagine an addict that doesn't want to examine their behavior so that they prevent relapses from occurring. As we end for tonight, is there anything else you want to add? Because you've been incredibly helpful. This is very simplistic and yet very powerful information. Anything else you want to add?
The only thing I would add is that one piece that we talk about that we mentioned briefly, I think one of the most important things in recovery is keeping a solid recovery routine going. And what I love to recommend to clients is journaling, meditation, exercise, and some sort of daily check-in on how they're doing. And that can be one of those activities, that routine, to help you stay in your center. So, and I guess the only other thing I would say is, Carol, thank you so much, not only for having me on your show, but just for providing this show in general. I think this is such a wonderful resource and such a great tool for everybody out there who is either working in or is struggling with sex addiction. I know that I'm always very grateful that you offer this.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It is a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to be working with people like you. So we will connect again, and I thank you for the recovery autopsy, Tim. You have a great week.
You too, Carol. Take care.
Okay. As you can see, that man has a host of knowledge, so please don't hesitate to give him a call. He really is there for you. He can't offer enough services. This guy is always working for the betterment of his sex addicts. I am Carol Jurgensen-Sheets. We'll see you next week. And as I say at the end of every show, there'll only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll catch you next week.